You're now tuned in to Cognitive Flow, brought to you by OptimalAnesthesia.com, where clinical insight meets focused clarity. Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
Our mission today, well, it takes us right into the heart of what we do every day. Hemodynamic management. You know, we spend so much time staring at those monitors, right? The MAP, the heart rate, the CVP, maybe cardiac output. And we react. We see a low number, we push a drug, we see a high number, maybe we deepen the anesthetic. But how often do we really think about the incredibly sophisticated conversation happening at the molecular level, the dialogue that actually dictates those numbers?
Exactly. That whole pushing numbers approach, it sort of misses the deeper picture, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The source material we're digging into today really hammers this home. Hemodynamic stability isn't just there. It's not the default. It's an active state, an equilibrium constantly maintained by these dynamic, very tightly regulated receptor processes. So our goal in this deep dive is to get beyond just reacting with a syringe. We want to understand that precise molecular logic, the logic that governs blood pressure, cardiac output, vascular tone, all of it.
Yeah, and the fundamental idea here is, well, it's quite elegant, really. The cardiovascular system is basically a communication network, a massive one, operating in real time. And the key players, the regulators, as our sources point out, are mainly these G-protein-coupled GPCRs and certain ion channels. So essentially, when we're managing a patient under anesthesia, we're not just manipulating pressures. We are actively intervening in this ongoing high-stakes molecular conversation.
And we need to be fluent in that conversation. That's the key. If we understand which receptor is being hit, which signaling pathway is firing, which mechanism might be getting tired or fatigued, then our drug choices become much more precise, like surgical strikes instead of just carpet bombing.
I like that analogy, surgical strikes versus carpet bombing.
Yeah.
Okay, let's lay the groundwork. So let's start by setting the scene. The moment we induce anesthesia or the surgeon makes the first incision, we're throwing challenges at this system's natural balance. Our sources outline, what, about five core disturbances that constantly test this homeostatic control?
Yeah, five big ones. And the most immediate, the one we see right away, is anesthetic-induced vasodilation. Doesn't matter if it's a volatile agent like Savo, kind of directly relaxing smooth muscle, or propofol with its more complex effects. We're actively making the pipes wider. Systemic vascular resistance goes down.
Right. The container gets bigger, but the volume stays the same initially. So pressure drops.
Yeah.
And the body's usual response often gets muffled, doesn't it? Because we've also attenuated the baroreceptor reflexes as the second challenge.
Exactly. Normally, if your MAP drops, sensors in the carotid and aorta scream, "Hey, pressure's low," and you get that quick compensatory tachycardia. But our anesthetics often blunt that reflex, so the heart rate just kind of sits there sluggish when it really needs to pick up the pace.
Okay, so we've relaxed the vessels and we've dampened the heart's immediate reaction.
Precisely. And then you add the third major challenge, sympathetic suppression. This is super obvious with regional anesthesia, right? A good spinal or epidural just chemically knocks out the sympathetic nerves below that level.
Yeah, you see the pressure drop almost immediately sometimes. Massive loss of vascular tone.
Huge. And then flip side, the fourth challenge is the opposite problem. Sudden, overwhelming sympathetic overdrive. Think about surgical stress incision, retraction, really painful stuff. You get these transient, but sometimes massive surges of catecholamines.
Leading to that sudden hypertension and tachycardia that makes everyone jump.
Makes everyone jump, exactly. And finally, number five, the sort of mechanical issues. Volume shifts and, of course, actual blood loss. Now, these aren't strictly molecular initially, but the body's response to maintain perfusion pressure when volume is low, that's entirely molecular. So each of these five things forces the body to rapidly rewrite its receptor-level dialogue just to keep things going.
That context is so important. Okay, let's get into the mechanics, the alphabet soup, as you called it, of G proteins. How do these receptors, these GPCRs, actually translate that external signal, a drug, a hormone, into a change inside the cell? This G protein framework seems central.
It really is. Think of the G protein, specifically its alpha subunit. That's the sort of active part. Think of it like a translator molecule docked right inside the cell membrane. When something binds to the receptor outside, like norepinephrine binding to an alpha receptor, it's like turning a key in a lock. This wakes up the G protein translator, and it starts speaking one of three key intracellular languages that basically control all hemodynamics.
Okay, three languages. Let's start with GQ. What conversation does GQ start?
GQ is the language of action, contraction, tightening things up. Its main job is to kick off a cascade that gets calcium moving. Specifically, GQ activates an enzyme called phospholipase C, or PLC. PLC then chops up a lipid in the membrane to make two crucial messengers, IPO and DAG,
IPO is the one that rushes over to the sarcoplasmic reticulum, the cell's calcium store, and tells it to release calcium.
Okay, so GQ basically says release the calcium.
Pretty much. And that surge in intracellular calcium, that's a direct command for smooth muscle cells to contract.
Got it. So if we need vasoconstriction, like with phenylephrine, we're speaking the GQ language.
Yeah.
That makes sense for alpha-1 receptors, and you mentioned V1 and AT1 too.
Exactly. That's the GQ family.
Yeah.
Now, next language, GS. DS stands for stimulatory. GS is kind of the language of energy, but interestingly, it can lead to either excitation or relaxation, depending on where it's spoken.
Okay, how does that work?
GS activates a different enzyme, adenyl cyclase. This enzyme cranks out huge amounts of another vital second messenger called CAMP, cyclic AMP.
Right, CMP, I remember that.
Okay.
So high CAMP, what does it do? You said it depends on the tissue.
It does. In the heart muscle cells, when a beta-1 receptor gets hit and GS boosts CAMP, that leads to increased heart rate and stronger contractions, more pump power.
Okay, excitation in the heart.
In vascular smooth muscle cells, if a beta-2 or a D1 receptor gets hit, GS boosts CAMP, and the result is vasodilation, relaxation.
Wait, how can the same molecule, CAMP, cause contraction in the heart but relaxation in the blood vessels? That seems counterintuitive.
It's all about what happens downstream from CAMP. Different toolkits and different cells. In the heart, CAMP activates something called protein kinase A, or PKA. PKA then phosphorylates calcium channels, letting more calcium in, boosting contraction. In the vascular muscle, PKA also gets activated, but the things it phosphorylates different. It actually inhibits the machinery needed for contraction, like myosin light chain kinase.
Okay. So PKA acts like a switch, but the wiring connected to that switch is different in the heart versus the vessel wall.
That's a great way to put it. The G pathway is versatile. Critical point.
Okay. And the third language, G. The inhibitory one.
G is the silencer. The I is for inhibitory. Its job is to shut down that same adenyl cyclase enzyme that G turns on. So G activation means less CMP is produced.
And where do we find G primarily?
Often on presynaptic nerve endings, like with alpha-2 receptors. Low CMP there means less neurotransmitters, like norepinephrine, gets released. So it effectively dampens nerve signals, why it's down sympathetic outflow.
Okay, this framework is powerful. GQ for squeeze, G's for go, or relax, depending where, and G for quiet. So now, if you see hypotension, you can start thinking molecularly. Is it a lack of GQ tone? Are the pipes too open because alpha-1 isn't working?
Or is it too much G's relaxation? Maybe beta-2 is overactive.
Or is it G's depression? Too much alpha-2 effect, maybe from dexmedetomidine, or just really deep anesthesia suppressing everything.
Exactly. And knowing the likely molecular culprit helps you choose the right countermeasure, the right drug to speak the right language.
All right, let's dive into the main players in this conversation, the adrenergic receptors, alpha and beta. We have to start with alpha-1. Our sources call it the lever for vascular tone. Seems about right.
Absolutely. Alpha-1 is your fundamental pressor receptor. It's pure GQ coupling, just like we discussed. Ligand binds, GQ activates PLC, you get IPA and DAG, calcium gets released from the SR, boom, vasoconstriction. It's fast, it's potent, and it happens across most systemic vascular beds.
Which is exactly why phenylephrine, being a pure alpha-1 agonist, is often the go-to for that quick fix, right?
Mm-hmm.
Especially in things like post-spinal hypotension, where the main issue is just sudden loss of tone.
It's the perfect key for that specific lock. You're essentially just turning a molecular tap to tighten the vasculature.
But you mentioned earlier, the response isn't always the same. The intensity of that constriction,
It
varies.
It does. And this is a really crucial molecular insight. The squeeze you get depends on more than just hitting the receptor. It also depends on receptor density, how many receptors are there, and importantly, on the cell's sensitivity to that calcium signal.
And that sensitivity, that's the hidden variable, isn't it? The thing we can't easily measure, but definitely see the effects of.
Totally. Take a patient with chronic hypertension. Their blood vessels might have actually upregulated alpha-1 receptors, or maybe the downstream signaling is just hyperreactive to calcium. They might overrespond. But then take someone deep under sevoflurane. Volatile anesthetics are known to reduce the sensitivity of smooth muscle to calcium. So even if you give phenylephrine and activate the GQ pathway, the cell doesn't hear the calcium signal as loudly. The response is blunted.
Right. You're speaking GQ, but the cell has its fingers in its ears, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, something like that.
And this leads to that really important clinical point about phenylephrine. You're getting pure vasoconstriction, no direct heart effects if you push too hard.
Two things happen almost immediately. First, the baroreceptors sense that rapid pressure rise and slam on the brakes via the vagus nerve that's your reflex bradycardia.
Yep, see that all the time.
Second, by cranking up the systemic vascular resistance, the SVR, you're dramatically increasing the afterload, the resistance the heart has to pump against. In a patient with a healthy heart, maybe no big deal. But if their ventricle is already struggling, that high afterload can seriously reduce stroke volume and overall cardiac output.
So the pressure number looks better, but the actual flow might be worse.
Precisely. That drop in heart rate and potentially stroke volume, that's the molecular system screaming too tight, too fast. We have to interpret that bradycardia correctly. It's a consequence of unopposed alpha-1 drive.
Okay, let's shift gears to alpha-1's cousin alpha-2, the sympathetic gateway, as the notes say. Completely different mechanism, right? This is GIA-coupled, inhibitory.
Totally different. Alpha-2 agonists like dexmedetomidine or clonidine are fascinating drugs. They act like the main brake on the sympathetic nervous system. You find lots of alpha-2 receptors presynaptically on the actual nerve endings that release norepinephrine.
Ah, so they work before the signal even gets sent out widely.
Exactly. When alpha-2 is activated, the G pathway inhibits adenyl cyclase, CMP levels drop, and this reduces the calcium influx needed for the nerve to release its norepinephrine vesicles. So they literally turn down the volume of any release at the source.
Reducing the fight or flight signal right where it starts.
Right. They aren't just blocking the downstream effects, they're reducing the amount of the messenger itself. Plus, they have central effects in the brainstem that add to sedation and overall sympatholysis.
Which is why they're so useful for, say, smoothing out emergence or reducing those perioperative stress surges. They kind of quiet the whole sympathetic orchestra.
Quiet the orchestra. I like that. And the molecular crosstalk is really elegant here. By suppressing N release via alpha-2, you indirectly reduce the stimulation of beta-1 receptors on the heart.
So you get heart rate control and stability.
But without the potential downsides of slamming the heart directly with a beta blocker, it's a more nuanced, endogenous way to control sympathetic tone. Stability through quietude, not force.
Nice. Okay, let's pivot to the heart itself. Beta-1 receptors, the cardiac accelerator, these are all about boosting the pump.
Beta-1 is your classic G's pathway in the heart. Activation right arrow, adenyl cyclase, right arrow CMP, surge right arrow PKA activation. And in heart muscle cells, as we said, PKA phosphorylates key calcium channels like the L-type calcium channel and proteins involved in calcium release from the SR like phospholamban. The net result is a big increase in intracellular calcium during each beat.
And functionally that translates to?
Stronger contractions, that's inotropy. Faster heart rate chronotropy. And faster conduction through the AV node dramatropy. It ramps up everything the heart does.
Which makes selective beta-1 agonists like dobutamine the tool for low output states, right? Mm. Cardiogenic shock, certain types of heart failure.
Exactly. When you need to directly stimulate the pump, beta-1 is the target. But and this is a huge, but in our world, there's a cost.
Oxygen consumption.
Right. Beta-1 stimulation makes the heart work much harder and faster. That dramatically increases myocardial oxygen demand. If the patient has underlying coronary artery disease where the oxygen supply is limited, you can easily tip them into ischemia. That molecular boost has a significant metabolic price tag. Use with caution.
Absolutely. It's a critical point. Okay, that naturally leads us to the other beta receptor, beta-2, the vascular release valve. Shares the G's pathway with beta-1, but totally opposite effect in smooth muscle.
Isn't that cool? Same initial cascade. G's right arrow, CMP, 2 right arrow, PKA. But as we touched on, in vascular smooth muscle, and bronchial smooth muscle too, PKA inhibits myosin light chain kinase, MLCK.
And MLCK is needed for contraction.
It's essential for phosphorylating myosin, allowing it to interact with actin and cause contraction. So if you inhibit MLCK, the muscle relaxes. Vasodilation, bronchodilation.
So same trigger, TRP, but opposite outcome based on the downstream machinery. And beta-2 receptors are found heavily in certain vascular beds.
Yes, especially in the blood vessels supplying skeletal muscle, which is a huge vascular territory. Also, coronary arteries and bronchial smooth muscle.
And clinically, this explains.
It explains the vasodilation you see with low-dose epinephrine. At low concentrations, epi preferentially hits the high-affinity beta-2 receptors, causing a drop in SVR, maybe even blood pressure.
Ah, right. The dose duality of epinephrine.
Exactly. Low-dose beta-2 vasodilation might dominate higher doses. The lower-affinity alpha-1 receptors get recruited, and the powerful vasoconstriction starts to overwhelm the beta-2 effect.
So when we titrate epi, we're essentially playing with the ratio of alpha-1 squeeze versus beta-2 relaxation.
You got it. We're tuning the adrenergic balance. It also partly explains why volatile anesthetics cause vasodilation. They might enhance some beta-2 signaling pathways or effects downstream.
Okay, let's move beyond the main adrenergic system. What happens when those pathways are maybe not enough or not the right fit? Let's talk about dopamine receptors first, specifically D1, targeted perfusion.
Yeah, the D1 receptor is really interesting for that reason. It's GS-coupled, just like beta-1 and beta-2. So activation boosts CMP. But the key is location. D1 receptors are found predominantly in the arteries supplying the kidneys, the gut, mesentery, the brain, and the heart.
So activating them causes vasodilation specifically in those vital beds.
Precisely. Selective vasodilation where you might want it most during periods of stress or low flow.
And the D2 receptor, different job.
Different job, different mechanism.
Hmm.
D2 is G-coupled. It's mostly found presynaptically, a bit like alpha-2, and it inhibits norepinephrine release. Adds another layer of complexity to dopamine's effects.
Okay, and that selective D1 vasodilation, that was the whole idea behind renal dose dopamine, wasn't it? Trying to protect the kidneys.
Exactly. The concept was sound from a molecular perspective. Use D1's G signaling to selectively dilate renal arteries and improve blood flow. Now, the big clinical trials, as you know, didn't really pan out to show a clear benefit in critically ill patients for routine use. It fell out of favor. Right now. The underlying principle, using receptor selectivity for targeted vasodilation, that's still a really important concept to grasp when thinking about regional perfusion and how different drugs work.
And dopamine itself is famous for its dose-dependent effects, switching between receptors.
Oh, absolutely. It's like three drugs in one, depending on the infusion rate. Lowest doses,
Yeah. You're
mainly hitting D1 receptors, getting that selective vasodilation. Medium doses, you start recruiting beta-1 receptors. Now you're getting increased heart rate and contractility, more pump support.
Right.
Highest doses. Finally, you overcome the D1 and beta effects with powerful alpha-1 receptor activation. Now you get systemic vasoconstriction, raising blood pressure. It's a fascinating journey across G's, G, and GQ pathways, all in one molecule, just based on concentration.
Very cool. Okay, let's talk about the real catecholamine bypass system, vasopressin. Why is this hormone, also called ADH, so critical when the standard adrenergic pressors seem to be failing?
Vasopressin is our ace in the hole for certain situations, especially refractory shock. It primarily acts on V1 receptors in the systemic vasculature. And molecularly, V1 is a pure GQ-coupled receptor.
Wait, GQ, same as alpha-1, causes calcium release and vasoconstriction?
Identical downstream mechanism, GQ right arrow PLC, right arrow IP3D dash, right arrow calcium, right arrow squeeze, potent vasoconstriction.
So if the mechanism is the same, why call it a bypass? Why does it work when, say, norepinephrine isn't?
This is the absolute key takeaway for refractory shock, like severe sepsis or vasoplegia after bypass. In those states, the body has been flooded with massive amounts of catecholamines, both its own and the ones we're infusing. This prolonged, intense stimulation causes the adrenergic receptors, particularly alpha-1 and beta-1, to become desensitized. Fatigue.
We mentioned that earlier. The beta arrestin thing.
Exactly. Beta arrestin gets involved, the receptors get phosphorylated, and then they literally get pulled off the cell surface and internalized, hidden away inside the cell.
The cell is basically saying, okay, too much noise, and hangs up the phone.
That's a perfect analogy. It hangs up the adrenergic phone. So if you keep pouring norepinephrine onto a cell that's internalized half its alpha-1 receptors, phone's off the hook, you get less and less response. Diminishing returns.
Okay.
Vasopressin completely sidesteps this problem. It uses the V1 receptor, which is an entirely separate GQ-coupled system. It hasn't been overstimulated by catecholamines. It hasn't been internalized by that specific mechanism. So it provides a fresh, potent vasoconstrictive signal through a pathway that's still functional.
It's like finding a different phone line that's still working when the main one is down.
Precisely. It bypasses the adrenergic fatigue.
And meanwhile, its other receptor, V2 in the kidneys, is doing something else.
Right. V2 receptors are in the kidney tubules. They are G-coupled, increasing CAMP, which leads to the insertion of aquaporin channels into the membrane. This pulls water back into the body, reducing urine output, antidiuresis.
So V1 squeezes the pipes, V2 helps fill the tank?
You got it. The clinical pearl is clear. Vaso is the molecular manual override for restoring vascular tone when catecholamines fail. It's particularly useful in states like ACE inhibitor-induced vasoplegia, where the patient's own angiotensin system, another key pressure regulator, is also blocked.
Speaking of angiotensin, we definitely need to cover the angiotensin II receptors. You call them the hydraulic pistons driving the RAAS system.
Yeah, the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, RAAS, is arguably the most powerful long-term regulator of blood pressure. Angiotensin II is the main effector hormone. It acts mostly on AT1 receptors. And guess what? AT1 is also GQ-coupled.
Another GQ player. So more vasoconstriction.
Potent vasoconstriction, yes. But AT1 does more. Activating it also directly stimulates the adrenal cortex to release aldosterone.
Yeah, aldosterone makes the kidneys hold onto salt and water.
Right. So angiotensin II via AT1 gives you a double hit. It increases vascular tone, and it increases intravascular volume over time, critical for maintaining pressure, especially when challenged.
But there's a balance, right? The AT2 receptors.
There is. AT2 receptors are generally thought to be G-coupled, and they serve a counter-regulatory role. They tend to promote vasodilation, partly through releasing nitric oxide and bradykinin. It's the balance between AT1 and AT2 signaling that allows for normal, adaptable vascular function.
Okay. But the clinical scenario we dread is the patient on chronic RAAS blockade, right?
Mm-hmm.
ECE inhibitors, ARBs.
Oh, absolutely. That's the RAAS blockade problem. These patients come to the OR with their baseline vascular tone already somewhat attenuated because a major pressure system is chemically inhibited.
And worse, their ability to respond to hypotension is blunted.
Severely blunted. They can't ramp up their own angiotensin II production effectively, so when they inevitably get hypotensive under anesthesia, they can become refractory to standard pressors like phenylephrine or even norepinephrine. They just tank.
Because the whole GQ pathway, AT1, is essentially offline for them.
Exactly. And this molecular vulnerability, this predictable failure point, is why synthetic angiotensin II was developed.
As a rescue agent.
As a third-line rescue agent, yeah, it directly stimulates those GQ-linked AT1 receptors. For a patient whose own Ang2 production is blocked or insufficient, giving synthetic Ang2 provides that missing signal, bypassing the blockade and offering another non-adrenergic way to restore vascular tone, recognizing that molecular deficiency is key.
Okay, we keep circling back to this idea of receptors getting tired. Receptor desensitization and plasticity. This seems fundamental to managing hemodynamics over more than just a few minutes.
It's absolutely fundamental, especially in critical care or longer cases. As we said, continuous high exposure to agonists, especially catecholamines, triggers protective mechanisms. The cell phosphorylates the receptor, which is often the first step. Then beta-arrestin comes along. It's like a little molecular flag binds to the phosphorylated receptor and signals for it to be pulled inside the cell. Internalized, endocytosed.
So the body literally reduces the number of available receivers on the surface when the signal gets too loud for too long.
That's the core idea. Protect the cell from overstimulation and potential damage. The clinical implication is huge. If your norepinephrine infusion is climbing higher and higher, just doubling the dose again is probably not the answer. You're likely hitting receptor saturation and just driving more desensitization.
That's the molecular cue to change tactics.
Exactly. That's when you need to think, okay, the adrenergic pathway is fatigued. Time to rotate to a different mechanism. Bring in vepotresin V1 or maybe angiotensin II AT1 if appropriate, because these use different receptors that haven't been subjected to the same better arrestin process from the catecholamines.
And this receptor regulation works the other way too, right? With chronic use and sudden withdrawal. You mentioned clonidine earlier.
Yeah, perfect example. If someone's been on an alpha-2 agonist like clonidine for a long time, the body compensates for that continuous inhibitory signal by upregulating the number of alpha-2 receptors. It puts more receivers out there trying to hear the diminished signal. Now, if you suddenly stop the clonidine, you remove that inhibitory brake, but you've got this massively increased population of hypersensitive alpha-2 receptors just waiting. The normal sympathetic outflow hits them, and you get an exaggerated response, potentially severe rebound hypertension, tachycardia, a sympathetic storm.
Wow. So we really have to respect the molecular memory of these systems. Tapering matters.
Absolutely. The receptor landscape isn't static. It's constantly adapting.
Which brings us neatly to how our anesthetics modulate this landscape. They aren't just innocent bystanders making patients unconscious. They are active molecular players.
Yeah. Profoundly active. Take the volatile agents SIVO, ISO, does. They cause vasodilation, partly, as we mentioned, by making the vascular smooth muscle less sensitive to calcium. They also seem to interfere directly with the GQ signaling cascade downstream from the alpha-1 receptor. So even if NE binds, the signal transmission is weaker.
They're messing with the internal wiring after the GQ signal starts.
Sort of, yeah. And propofol, it has its own ways.
Right. What are propofol's main vascular effects?
It seems to cause direct, smooth muscle relaxation through at least two big mechanisms. First, it inhibits calcium entry through L-type calcium channels. Less calcium coming in means less contraction.
Okay.
Second, it appears to enhance the effects of endothelial nitric oxide, NO. And NO is a very potent endogenous vasodilator that works via a completely different pathway involving CGMP.
So propofol hits calcium channels and boosts NO, double relaxation effect.
Pretty much, which explains why it can drop the blood pressure so effectively, especially on induction.
And then there's ketamine, the odd one out. It often raises blood pressure.
Ketamine's different because it has significant central nervous system effects that lead to sympathetic stimulation. It indirectly causes norepinephrine release, probably acting on NMDA receptors centrally, which then modulates sympathetic outflow.
So it sort of counteracts the vasodilation you might otherwise see from anesthesia.
Often, yes. It provides an intrinsic sympathomimetic effect via central beta-1 activation and NE release, which helps maintain or even increase heart rate and blood pressure. We have to see anesthetics not just as hypnotics, but as drugs that actively reshape the patient's receptor responses and signaling environment.
Okay, we've built a foundation. We understand the language GQ, GSG, and the key receptors. Now let's put it together. Precision pharmacology, matching the drug to the specific molecular need.
This is where it gets really practical. When you choose a vasopressor, you're consciously choosing which G protein pathway to activate and where. Norepinephrine. You're hitting alpha-1, GQ for tone, and beta-1, GS for cardiac contractility and rate. It's balanced. Addresses both vascular failure and pump failure. That's why it's first line for septic shock. You need both squeeze and pump support.
Okay, makes sense. Phenylephrine.
Pure alpha-1 GQ. All about restoring vascular tone. Nothing for the heart directly. Ideal for that pure vasodilatory state, like post-spinal, assuming the heart is okay. But watch out for that reflex bradycardia and the increased afterload.
Right. And vasopressin.
Vasopressin is V1 GQ. But crucially, it's catecholamine-independent tone restoration. Your go-to when you suspect adrenergic receptors, alpha-1, are desensitized or fatigued, like in severe sepsis or vasoplegia, it's the bypass pathway.
Got it. Now, let's differentiate the inotropes molecularly. Dobutamine versus milrinone. Big difference, right?
Huge difference in mechanism. Dobutamine is the direct route. It's primarily a beta-1 agonist. It binds to the receptor, activates Gs, increases KMP, and boosts cardiac contractility that way. Simple, direct stimulation.
But it needs working beta-1 receptors.
Absolutely. If those receptors are downregulated or desensitized, like in chronic heart failure or maybe septic cardiomyopathy, the dobutamine might not work well.
Enter milrinone, the bypass.
Exactly. Milrinone doesn't care about the receptor. It's a phosphodiesterase 3 inhibitor, a PDE3 inhibitor.
The PDE3 is the enzyme that normally breaks down KMP.
Correct. So by inhibiting the breakdown crew, PDE3, milrinone causes CMP levels inside the cell to skyrocket. You get the same downstream effect, increased contractility, but you achieved it by preventing the messenger's destruction, not by stimulating its production at the receptor level.
That's clever. So it works even if the beta-1 receptors are shot.
That's its major advantage in situations like beta blocker overdose or severe heart failure with receptor downregulation. It bypasses the faulty receptor communication line entirely. Plus, PDE3 is also present in vascular smooth muscle. Inhibiting it there also increases KMP, leading to vasodilation.
So milrinone is an enodilator, increases contractility, and reduces afterload.
Precisely. Makes it very useful for certain types of heart failure, especially right heart failure where you want pulmonary vasodilation too.
Okay. And briefly, vasodilators. They all want relaxation, but they get there differently.
They generally converge on either reducing intracellular calcium availability or increasing the other relaxing messenger, CGMP. Nitroglycerin, for instance, is primarily an NO donor. Nitric oxide stimulates granulate cyclase, which makes CGMP. CGMP then promotes smooth muscle relaxation, especially in veins. So nitro primarily reduces preload.
Okay.
Sodium and nitric peroxide is also an NO donor, but it seems to hit both arterioles and veins more evenly, giving you both preload and afterload reduction. It's about knowing which side of the circulation, venous preload or arterial afterload, you're primarily targeting.
Fascinating. Let's talk about receptor crosstalk. This idea that multiple signals are happening at once, influencing each other.
Yeah, the body rarely sends just one signal. It's always a balance. We mentioned alpha-2 activation inhibits NE release, which indirectly tones down beta-1 stimulation. That's crosstalk. Or think about the kidney. D1 receptor activation causes vasodilation there, which might counteract some of the systemic alpha-1 vasoconstriction happening elsewhere, helping preserve renal perfusion. It's a complex interplay.
Checks and balances.
Definitely. And understanding this explains why combination therapy is often better, especially in severe shock.
Like the norepinephrine plus vasopressin example for sepsis.
Perfect example. Why is that often superior to just cranking up the norepi?
Because you're engaging two distinct vasoconstrictive pathways, adrenergic, alpha-1, and non-adrenergic, V1. You get synergistic effects, you likely mitigate the risk of severe desensitization on the alpha pathway, and you provide more robust, balanced support. It's hitting the problem from two different molecular angles. Much smarter than just pushing one pathway to its breaking point.
Okay, let's solidify this with a couple of quick case scenarios. Molecular diagnosis time. First case, septic shock. Patient is on huge doses of norepinephrine. Pressure still isn't great. What's the molecular diagnosis?
Okay, refractory septic shock on high-dose norepi. Molecular diagnosis. Primarily alpha-1 and probably beta-1 receptor desensitization. Likely significant beta arrest and mediated internalization. Plus, often relative vasopressin deficiency, the body's own stores are depleted.
And the molecular treatment strategy. Two-pronged. First, switch the pathway. Add vasopressin to engage the fresh V1 receptors and restore GQ-mediated tone via a non-adrenergic route. Second, consider resensitization. Steroids, like hydrocortisone, are thought to help stabilize and upregulate adrenergic receptors over time, improving their responsiveness. We're directly addressing the molecular failure.
Nice. Case 2, intubation. Patient maybe has some known cardiac issues, and during laryngoscopy, their pressure and heart rate skyrocket.
Okay, intubation-induced hypertension and tachycardia. Molecular diagnosis. Massive acute sympathetic surge triggered by the stimulus. Huge release of norepinephrine and epinephrine hitting both alpha-1 and beta-1 receptors hard.
Treatment strategy. We need to act fast.
Rapid molecular counterattack. Often the priority is controlling the heart rate and oxygen demand. So quick beta-1 blockade with something short-acting like Esmolol is common. Quiet the heart first. Then manage the pressure if needed, maybe with more anesthetic or a vasodilator, but remember the crucial rule we talked about?
Right. Never give beta blockade first if you suspect massive sustained catecholamine excess, like an unknown pheochromocytoma.
Never, ever. Because if you block the beta-2 mediated vasodilation without first blocking the alpha-1 vasoconstriction, you get unopposed alpha stimulation.
And the pressure goes through the roof.
Dangerously high. Catastrophic hypertension, potentially acute heart failure from the massive afterload. The molecular sequence of blockade is critical in those rare, high catecholamine states. Block alpha first, then beta.
It really highlights how just looking at the MAP isn't enough, doesn't it? A high MAP from excessive phenylephrine might look good numerically, but if it's choking off cardiac output due to afterload, that's bad perfusion.
Exactly. We have to constantly interpret those numbers within the molecular context of the drugs we're using and the patient's underlying state. What pathway generated that number? What are the downstream consequences? #tagoutratitude.
Wow. This deep dive really changes how you think about pressing plungers, doesn't it? Hemodynamic control isn't just about filling tanks or adjusting simple pressures. It's this incredibly intricate art of molecular orchestration. It's about mixing alpha, beta, V1, AT1 signals, GQ, GS, G, in just the right ratios, moment by moment, to keep cells perfused. Every drug we give is a word in that molecular dialogue.
That's the goal, really. Moving beyond just reacting to numbers and towards maybe precision hemodynamic design, thinking proactively about the molecular balance. You're not just managing a blood pressure, you're managing interacting molecular pathways. And the skill of the anesthesiologist lies in becoming truly fluent in that molecular language. So maybe the final thought to leave everyone with is this. Next time you glance at the monitor, ask yourself what specific molecular mechanism is likely dominant in this patient's hemodynamics right now. Is it GQ failure? GS overdrive? Is there desensitization happening? What language do I need to speak next? Definitely something to mull over.
Thanks for joining us on today's episode of Optimal Anesthesia. For in-depth notes, visuals, and bonus content, head over to optimalanesthesia.com. Support the learning. Support the craft. See you in the next one.